Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So picture this. It's February 2004. The aftermath of the invasion of Iraq is going as poorly as it possibly could. David Kaye, the head of the Iraq Study Group, which has been charged with searching for weapons of mass destruction, has just resigned, stating that he could see nothing to conclude that Iraq had WMDs. You remember that. Now CIA Director George Tenet comes knocking on your door, asking you to head up the study group and finish the search and write up a report on whether the whole premise for the war in Iraq actually existed in the first place. Tough spot, right? Well, it was Charles Delfer's door that George Tenet knocked on, and Delfer did take over the ISG, which ultimately released their findings in the fall of 2004 and confirmed that Iraq did not, in fact, have stockpiles of WMDs. In his new book, Charles Delfer tells the story of the Iraq Study Group, but also that of his decades-long involvement with Iraq, starting in the early 1990s as a member of the UN Special Commission on Iraq. The book is called Hide and Seek: The Search for Truth in Iraq. It's out now from Public Affairs Books. We are pleased to welcome Charles Delfer to our studios. Thank you so much for coming in.
Brian, thank you for inviting me.
And a lot of what your book does is tell a compelling narrative from one place of a story that a lot of our listeners know the broad outlines of. But there are so many new tidbits in this story, and I wonder if we could start by going through a few of these that I think are very telling. One, Saddam Hussein actually went to his advisors, you write, to ask if he had weapons of mass destruction that he didn't know about. That happened?
It did happen. In a meeting in October of 2002, Saddam had a meeting of his Revolutionary Command Council, which is sort of like a cabinet-level meeting where all his people sit around the table and he holds forth at one end. And at this point in time, the British and the American intelligence organizations and politicians have been, you know, making a public case that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. There was a bit about, you know, the Brits had said that they could launch chemical weapons within 45 minutes. And so Saddam addresses his assembled minions and says, hey, these guys in Washington and in London seem to be pretty convinced that we've got these stocks. And he looks around his people and says, well, there's nothing here that you aren't telling me, guys. And you know, these bobbleheads around him all shake their heads and no, boss, that would be impossible. But, you know, there was so much that...
This is because President Bush and everyone else were so insistent publicly that he had weapons of mass destruction, he maybe thought he had ones that he didn't even know about?
That was, you know, one of the weaknesses of the way he operated. You know, he could not fully trust the information which was presented to him. What I try to do in this book is really reflect, you know, not just the American and the United Nations perspective, but try to bring the reader the perspective of Baghdad, of how they saw the world. And that's a side that we too often, you know, ignore in Washington.
So here's another tidbit from the book that'll let you expound on that, I think. And this one's amazing, and it goes back to the Clinton years. Iraqi officials actually approached the Clinton administration about setting up a line of communication to collaborate on counterterrorism, Israel-Palestine, and going after the 1993 World Trade Center bombers, and the Clinton White House didn't respond. Do I have that right?
That is correct. And you know, this is in many ways a classic tragedy between Iraq and the Western world, and Washington in particular. Baghdad did not fully understand Washington, and Washington did not fully understand Baghdad. Baghdad, and Saddam in particular, thought that it was natural that the United States would recognize that Iraq was a natural ally or friend in the region. Iraq had was secular, westward-leaning, basically, or great engineers and resources, of course, with their oil reserves. After the Kuwait War, over time, the Saddam regime thought, well, the Americans, you know, must come to a realization that we are their natural ally. And Saddam, who derived a lot of prestige in the region by being the guy standing up to the last superpower, along the lines that, you know, your prestige is associated with the size of your enemy. He was the guy who was standing up to the last superpower. By the same token, he could equally receive prestige by being aligned with the United States. So he kept making these offers through me and, in fact, others that, you know, look, we'll be your best friend in the region, bar none. But what they did not understand was that the position in Washington was quite different. Any administration in Washington, to establish a dialogue at that time with Saddam would have been, you know, soundly criticized by the opposing political party, and in particular the Clinton administration had been weakened by the Monica Lewinsky affair and so forth. So they were not in a position to you know, make those kinds of dialogues.
Was it sincere? Because people don't take Saddam Hussein at his word, didn't when he was alive and in power. Was there really counterterrorism cooperation that he was proposing in any sincere way? Wasn't he paying money to families of Palestinians who died in terrorist attacks? Didn't he have some oblique connection to the people who did the 1993 World Trade Center bombing?
He did, but I think the offer of a dialogue and an evolution of a relationship with the United States was genuine. All of these things were methods that he could derive leverage, which he could, you know, then give up. I think, it, you know, in retrospect, when you look at the cost of the war in Iraq and, you know, the cost of removing Saddam from power, many Iraqis after the war, people I knew very well from the regime, they said, well, why on earth did you have to go to war? Why couldn't you have gotten close to Saddam and then maneuvered him out? You know, there were so many around him who would be happy to have seen him, you know, on his way out the door. So, you know, in retrospect, we look back and say, were there other tactics and approaches we could have pursued to solve the Saddam problem?
Former UN Chief Weapons Inspector Charles Delfer, my guest on WNYC. His book, Hide and Seek, The Search for Truth in Iraq. He worked as a CIA analyst, diplomat, other positions in Iraq for many years, including before the war. Another tidbit that will be new to our listeners. Before the war, you wrote up a list of people within Iraq who you had gotten to know who could help run Iraq after the invasion. And this list was instead used as a list of targets by U.S. forces?
Well, it was a missed opportunity. It's not that these some of the people who I knew and others knew in the regime who could have been very helpful to us in the transition when American forces got to Baghdad, some of them were, you know, inadvertently arrested or put on lists, blacklists and so forth. But the larger point here is that you know, the administration elected to believe and use the information with respect to weapons of mass destruction from the intelligence community, which was largely wrong. That was not the most costly mistake, however. The more costly mistake, in my opinion, was a decision by the White House to not use CIA contacts and relationships with Iraqis inside Iraq who could have made a transition much more smooth, and we would not have had the ensuing 4 years of chaos. It's in my opinion and my argument in this book that had we made proper decisions in the fall of 2002 and early 2003, we would be where we are now in Iraq, but 4 years earlier without the cost of billions of dollars, thousands of lives.
I want to play for you, as we start to look to the future, a couple of clips from the foreign policy parts of President Obama's speech last night. And these pertain especially to Iraq, since that's your expertise. Here's what he said about wasted money there.
We'll eliminate the no-bid contracts that have wasted billions in Iraq. And reform our defense budget so that we're not paying for Cold War-era weapon systems we don't use.
Do you have a reaction to that?
Well, every president, you know, attempts to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse in the defense budget. Every president subsequently has to confront the aerospace industries, and they have well-established relationships in every state, every congressional district supporting various weapon systems. It is an admirable objective. How much he will actually be able to squeeze out of the defense budget, I wish him all the luck in the world. It's a tough row to hoe. The ultimate problem is that, you know, the government is not good at doing brain surgery. You know, we have very limited tools, and you know, you have to pick the objectives that you want to pursue very carefully, because you better want to do them very badly, because the government will probably do them very badly.
He also added this.
Finally, because we're also suffering from a deficit of trust, I am committed to restoring a sense of honesty and accountability to our budget. That is why this budget looks ahead 10 years and accounts for spending that was left out under the old rules. And for the first time, that includes the full cost of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. For 7 years, we've been a nation at war. No longer will we hide its price.
Any reaction to that?
Well, the reason why the budget for the Iraq war was offline, I mean, had to do with the complications and the cost growth and the way it was handled in Congress. I mean, it's certainly admirable to build that budget and put it back into the normal process rather than having these supplementals, and I think the president is quite correct to focus on that. The savings to be derived from the Iraq war will be sizable, I think, but it, you know, in the reality, it may not be as large as people would like to believe.
Your argument, the one you were making before, that we could have removed the top of the Iraqi structure, Saddam and his top henchmen, while still leaving much of the government and army in place, could that approach apply to Iran as well, not through a military action, but politically?
There are lessons to be learned from the Iraq experience for Iran, but it is important to remember Iran is a very different country. It's got a population of 70 million. There is a different type of political structure there. One of the lessons I would point to is that we paid an enormous price for our ignorance about the regime in Baghdad, and part of that ignorance derived because we had no embassy. For, you know, a decade, I was about the only senior American that met with the Iraqis. And, you know, over time, that we paid a huge price for that. So I would look at Iran and say, look, at to the extent that we can get more Americans there who have direct contact with leading Iraqi figures, including in the government, you know, that's all to the good. We pay a huge price for ignorance.
We pay a huge price for ignorance. Now, what allowed you, since we didn't have official relations with Iraq, to have all this contact? What was your role, actually?
Because during the 1990s, I was assigned to the United Nations, and the United Nations was the group that was conducting the weapons inspections. I was the deputy chairman of that group. So, you know, I had a decade of experience with Saddam and his top people and knew them very, very well. I did not think of myself as an Iraq expert until I saw the decisions which were being made in Washington by people who had never seen a living, breathing Iraqi.
And do you think that Bush and Cheney and anyone else lied to the American people or exaggerated to the American people whatever they actually believed to be the case with weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
I think President Bush, after 2001, you know, really looked at Iraq as a problem which had to be solved. He was guided to do this with international backing and say, if you go through the United Nations, there's no way Saddam can comply with the requirements that he get rid of his WMD. That turned out to be a bad judgment politically. It also turned out that the intelligence on the WMD programs was wrong.
And you write in your book, and I want to make sure we get this out, that the CIA was locked out, and you're a CIA guy, the CIA was locked out by the Pentagon?
With respect to judgments and providing assistance and evaluations on the internal political situation in Iraq, the CIA and everyone else, we were wrong on WMD. We had our hypothesis. You know, we assumed Saddam had this stuff. He would be crazy not to have it, was our assumption. And, you know, you tend to look for data which supports your existing hypothesis. We made that mistake.
So Bush and Cheney were wrong or relying on wrong information? They didn't lie?
They overhyped it. They overamped it. You know, politicians, we elect politicians. We don't elect intelligence analysts. Politicians, you know, choose a course of action, and then they have to build support in our country. And this is something which Saddam did not have to do. And in the course of building support for their course of action, speech writers, you know, tend to write things which sound better, and then they check for precision later.
Colin Powell?
Colin Powell, you know, he had a different perspective on this. I think, you know, in some ways he was, he gave the president advice about what would be possible in the UN, which was, you know, incorrect as well. He said, well, look, you know, you'll get what you want. Saddam will not be able to comply. None of these guys asked weapons inspectors, because the weapons inspectors probably would have said, well, we don't think Saddam has fully complied, but you're going to have a very difficult time demonstrating that, because these guys are very good at hiding things.
Huh. All right. That is where we leave it with Charles Duffer, his fascinating new book called Hide and Seek, The Search for Truth in Iraq. He was the chief weapons inspector for the Iraq Study Group in 2004. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.